This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today's guest, historian Peter Cole, writes about the often forgotten history of how dock workers in Durban, South Africa, and the San Francisco Bay Area successfully fought for workers' rights and racial equality. They persevered when a new technology, container ships, sent a shockwave of layoffs throughout the industry, and they sparked international work stoppages to protest apartheid and authoritarianism. In his new book, Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area, Peter Cole writes, dock workers have power, integral to shipping, the world's first global industry, and hence instrumental to the rise of capitalism. These so-called unskilled workers amassed through collective action, ideological commitment, and sheer force of will, a surprising amount of power. As any other human being would, they've used their leverage to improve their own lot. Peter Cole is a professor of history at Western Illinois University. He is co-director of the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 Commemoration Project. His first book is called Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia. And his most recent book is Dock Worker Power. And Peter will be at the California Historical Society tonight at 6 o'clock. And you can find information on that at yourcallradio.org. That is in San Francisco. And Peter Cole joins us in studio. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for coming in. This is a really interesting book, and as you and so many of the reviewers say, it's an often forgotten history. When you talk about the workers in Durban, South Africa, and dock workers in San Francisco, and you write about so many parallels, why did you decide to focus on these two regions?
Well, I first wanted to study the San Francisco Bay Area because the history of the dock workers in the Bay Area is so important. I always say if you think you know the Bay Area and you don't understand the centrality of the port and its workers, actually you don't know the city you live. Mm. But in Durban, well, there's also a long history of militant workers who contributed to the struggle for racial equality and liberation. And so I just so happened to know that these parallels existed, and I wanted to dig more about it, but also to share this with others, because too often we focus inward when, in fact, the world is the world, right? Like, and focusing inward, in fact, misses much of the history, especially in an industry where that's, by definition, one that connects people across borders as opposed to just inside.
And you visited South Africa in the early 2000s when you were teaching U.S. history in Tanzania?
That's right.
That must have been so interesting.
It was a great experience to teach Tanzanians, U.S. history in Tanzania, in East Africa. And when I was there, I spent a few weeks, I flew to South Africa because the struggle against apartheid is, in a way, the most important social movement of the second half of the 20th century, and it's a blueprint for many of the problems of our day. Climate change, in particular, has lifted whole pages of the playbook from the struggle against apartheid, as they should. And so I think the other part is that actually we don't appreciate the power that we as workers have. Mm. And when we think of social movements, we often leave out, in fact, our greatest power.
I'm just curious, what part of U.S. history did you decide to teach to students in Tanzania?
Oh, yeah, well, it was what we would call a survey. So beginning in pre-colonial times and then taking it into the late 20th century, one of the interesting experiences I had was how interested Tanzanians were in indigenous American history. Mm. And so they often asked me questions that my U.S. students actually rarely ask. And I found that to be instructive. Yeah.
Wow, that's so interesting. We can do an entire probably show on that.
Yeah.
So then when you visited Durban, this is South Africa's greatest port city?
Mm-hmm. It's also the busiest port in Africa and one of the busiest in Southern Hemisphere.
And how busier, what does that mean exactly when you're talking about the comparison to the Bay Area port?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, like the Bay Area was the biggest port in the American West for 100-150 years, but in the 70s, the port of L.A. Long Beach surpassed, mm-hmm. right? And so actually the port that we're familiar with in the Bay Area is important, but L.A. Long Beach is actually more so. Durban, well, you know, the United States is still the largest economy in the world, and so the amount of shipping that comes in and out of the United States' major ports are greater than the ports of Durban or any other port on the African continent. It's worth noting, actually, though, that I believe that 8 of the 10 largest ports in the world are in East Asia, right? And so Americans don't appreciate how 7 of those 8, I think, are in China.
Wow.
And that tells us about the world today.
This is interesting. I don't know if you know this, but what's the status of workers in China's ports?
Well, I don't have an answer to that question. Generally speaking, dock workers are pretty well compensated for what are considered manual or blue-collar workers nowadays in many countries, including the U.S. and South Africa. In fact, dock workers in America often get paid more than professors in America.
Wow.
But in China, I don't have an answer to that question.
Okay. So let's go to Durban then. You say that from 1950 to 1994, the history of Durban docker activism was actually part of the larger struggle against apartheid. Mm. Most of Durban's dock workers were black, and so they were denied legal protections created by and for white South Africans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, actually the entire workforce of the waterfront in Durban was black because by law, workers couldn't be of different races and work together. And so as harsh and as cruel as segregation was in the United States, it actually was far more cruel in South Africa. And an important distinction is also that upwards of 85% of South Africans are non-white, as opposed to, you know, 12% of Americans who are African-American, right? And so, but in Durban, you know, these workers, black people, essentially didn't have legal rights. I mean, they weren't covered under the Constitution. And so they could therefore be mistreated in all sorts of ways. They were very, very poor. And that's why they had little political power. And so where do you have power? Well, I'm not the first to suggest it, but like black workers were able to sort of demonstrate power because if you shut down the most important port in the country and it's an export economy, right, and in fact not just impacts that city but actually the country, and it especially historically exported raw materials like and precious metals, gold, diamonds, platinum, right, like and so getting stuff in and out, that's really important for most countries, right? And so these poor black workers who had no legal rights, in fact, had tremendous power with the most simple action, which is to stop work,
to stop work.
We call a strike.
And because they didn't have legal protections, they couldn't go on strike, they couldn't unionize, and they had to live in seaside hostels?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was another difference. I mean, comparative history is fascinating. We have to be close enough. You have to be apples and apples, right? But then, of course, there's an endless variety of apples, right? And so there are differences, of course, between South Africa and the U.S. and differences between Durban and Bay Area dock workers. Although the majority of Bay Area dock workers in the last 50 years are African Americans, they weren't legally forced to live in essentially housing by the port, right? Of course, before really the 70s, there was intense ghettoization of African-Americans. So in West Oakland and on this side of the bay, right, most black dock workers actually lived in Oakland, even though up until the 70s, actually most of the work was in San Francisco, right? Most white dock workers in the Bay Area actually lived in San Francisco. I interviewed many elderly dock workers, and it's always interesting to go to a dock worker's house, which he owns in San Francisco, when it's hard to imagine owning a home in San Francisco. And these are blue-collar workers, right? Like, it tells us a story of what San Francisco was like. But in particular, it was because the port, it was because the industry, right? And so once the port moved to Oakland, that in the 70s, basically, most of the work moved because of the technological change. Light industry followed, right? Like, and so the industrial work just didn't have any reason to be in the city once the port moved, and the port moved because of that process called containerization, these large metal boxes that are moved up and down on cranes, stacked on ships, but then loaded also onto trucks and trains once they're land-based, right? And so that new system resulted in manufacturing moving to lower-wage countries, but it also resulted in massive changes in the industry. It also resulted in a massive increase in global trade.
Right. And so can you talk more, though, about just given how brutal the racism was and is in South Africa, what did you learn about how these black dock workers organized, given that they had no protections, they could not unionize? Talk about how they kind of came together in solidarity, advocated for themselves, but also fought against apartheid.
Right. Well, I say that sort of ipso facto, any example of power by black people is a threat to the state. And so often when black workers were demanding change, they were actually demanding for raises usually. They were desperately poor and they wanted to be less poor. But that was understood by everybody as actually it's not only about money. It's never only about money. Because, of course, if some people are able to drive up their wages and improve their conditions, others will follow. Right? Like, and so even without any legal protections, the right to unionize or strike, for example, black workers organized. Why? Well, actually in past and present, dock workers are more likely to be union than almost any other industry in the world. Why? Because the work is collective. Also, often brutal conditions result in shared suffering and therefore common identities and us versus them mentality, right? These people are also almost entirely of the same ethnic group, Zulus. So they shared that in common. As you noted earlier, they lived together too. So they didn't just work together, they lived together. And they socialized together because there was actually blacks weren't allowed to travel in the city freely because of apartheid. And so they had few social options, and one was called the African Beer Hall. So you literally sleep together, drink together, work together, and you're from the same rural KwaZulu neighborhoods or communities, not neighborhoods. And so they shared much in common. It is always easier. The trick is to appreciate that you share that in common. Now, in America, for instance, a more diverse working class, that's often been a wedge used by employers, right? Like, oh, don't dislike me, the boss, dislike that white guy who took your job, or that black guy, or that immigrant, right? Like, and so workers in America and other multi-ethnic societies also have to be mindful that that wedge has been effectively used time and again, including in our times, right? Like, and so therefore, you have to bring that logic with you, but that alone isn't sufficient because I could explain that, but actually is not necessarily convincing if you have certain prejudices. In the history of the LWU, most famously its leader, Harry Bridges, but many of its rank-and-file followers were socialists, right? And so they believed that these ethnic and racial identities, while not insignificant, were in fact irrelevant to the boss, and so therefore should be irrelevant to workers, right? Like, and so that we have to be multiracial, and the LWU has been, especially in the Bay Area, anti-racist since the mid-30s, 30 years before the Civil Rights Act, right? This union was integrated its own ranks and then drastically recruited people of color in the 40s and 50s and 60s to create the black majority local that's existed since the 60s.
And where did that come from?
Well, like I said, it's really, I say, sort of the pragmatism. We have to sort of, if we want to improve our lot, we have to work together, right? But the pragmatism is insufficient because I just explained it, but it doesn't work necessarily. Like, there's lots of racist unions and working people, right? And so therefore, it also means you got to bring the ideology. And that's why the socialism was really important for these people. To give you an example of how they operationalized this, they created a system of hiring. Once they were in control, the bosses would call the union hall. The union elected their own dispatchers. And if you showed up at the hall for work one day, who did the dispatcher pick? That worker who had the least amount of hours in that quarter of the year got the first opportunity to work. They called it low man out. And so that's socialism in action, actually. It's sort of incredible. And so they share, then everyone was committed to this because, well, it was radicals who created the union in the first place. And then it sort of, people, again, you sort of are build this power, but through the community, as Herb Mills, a legendary dock worker in the Bay Area who passed away a few years ago, he called it, you know, the community, right? That the union and the hiring hall and the low man out system and the election of your own leaders together all built this culture of solidarity.
Today, we're speaking with Professor Peter Cole about his new book, Dockworker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. Professor Cole teaches history at Western Illinois University, and he's co-director of the Chicago Race Riot of 1919 Commemoration Project. His last book is Wobblies on the Waterfront, Interracial Unionism in Progressive Era Philadelphia. And if you have any questions or comments for Professor Peter Cole, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. In 1934, the ILWU led their first strike, known as the Big Strike, which shut down every port on the United States Pacific Coast.
For the summer. You know, San Francisco was the biggest port at that time, had been since the 1840s. But it was up and down the coast from San Diego up to sort of Seattle, right? Like, you know, the Big Strike, which the union did not exist yet. It was sort of born out of the ashes, right? But there was a union, a different union that they ultimately recreated. But the Big Strike shut things down, right? Then after a month or so, more than a month, employers got the assistance of the San Francisco police. They tried to sort of break the strike in what was nicknamed Bloody Thursday because several workers were killed on July 5th, 1934. That resulted in, workers across many industries joining in what was called the General Strike of 1934. So the city of San Francisco shut down for the better part of the week, right, in solidarity with the maritime workers' strike. Back in Washington, D.C., a very different president, arguably the most pro-worker president America's ever had, and the first female cabinet secretary, Francis Perkins, Secretary of Labor, they pushed the employers to negotiate because it was in 34 and 35 that workers in America finally got the legal right to unionize and strike. And so policy matters out of the White House. Elections matter, right? Like not just in 2019, but also in 32 when FDR won in a landslide.
And on May Day in 2015, Local 10 members stopped work to protest the police killings of black people in the Bay Area and also South Carolina. And some of the stories about this union are just, there's so many.
It's an incredible union. That's why I said the Bay Area ILW Local 10 deserves much respect. Not perfect, but nevertheless pretty impressive. Often in recent years, they've coordinated actions on May 1st, International Worker Day, which was born in America, but we celebrate it not coincidentally in early September because that's when Congress put it in order for us to forget our history, right? But some of us don't forget, and some of those people are in the ILW, right? And so in 2007, they shut down the ports up and down the entire West Coast to protest U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But in 2015, they stopped work on May 1st to protest police killings of black men in multiple places, including South Carolina, where a black man was killed by a white police officer, and famously a black man caught it on video. The white police officer planted a gun next to the man who was running away from him when he was shot in the back and was claiming self-defense. And so again, this predominantly black social justice union in the Bay Area sort of is not just acting on behalf of local issues, but national issues. Martin Luther King was actually an honorary member of Local 10. He was inducted in the year before his death. And when he was killed, ILW shuts down the port whenever a worker is killed on the job. They actually shut down on April 4th, 1968, the port, right, in honor of their fellow worker who had just been slain. It's incredible.
You have an amazing passage in the book about this. You write, MLK repeatedly encouraged black workers to join and form unions, famously calling them the first anti-poverty program. Addressing a large gathering of dock workers, King declared, "I don't feel like a stranger here in the midst of the ILWU. We've been strengthened and energized by the support you've given to our struggles. We've learned from labor the meaning of power."
Yeah, well, another favorite King quote, right, is, you know, what good is it to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a hamburger? I know that you and I are vegans, right? But the idea of that political equality is useless if you're poor.
Right.
Like,
So I just wonder, writing this book, thinking about where we are today when so many people cannot afford to buy the hamburger. I mean, we just got, and in fact, I want to make sure I have my numbers right, because a Pew report just came out that found about half of workers are low-wage workers today, making less than about 18 grand a year.
Yeah.
So we hear about these job numbers, about how unemployment is so low, but we should also hear that these are so many of these jobs are low-wage paying jobs.
Well, I mean, the Bay Area is sort of a great place but a terrible place, right, because the extremes are glaring. I took a bus here, and I watched as four San Francisco police officers boarded this bus with me and were checking fare cards to make sure everyone had paid on the bus. Four police officers with guns are checking these disproportionately non-white people, many of whom with health issues, kick him off the bus, writing citations. And I'm thinking to myself, this is how the city's going to balance the budget? No, it's like a sort of, if you had free public transit, you wouldn't have these problems, right? Like, but there are so many examples, unfortunately, of the haves and have-nots being ever more widened. Let me just say that South Africa, 25 years after the end of apartheid, is actually, by many accounts, the most extremely unequal society in the world. And so for all the victories of the struggle against apartheid, with fair elections and black political positions of power, almost all the poor people of the country are non-white. And it's, if you think San Francisco is glaring in its inequality, you should visit Johannesburg.
Wow. What else can you tell us about that?
It's like the National Revolution succeeded, right? Multiracial democracy, that's great. But there was no changes to wealth, right? Like, and so what in America, the conversation is called reparations. They use different terms in South Africa. But the hope was, going back to the 50s, was that there would be a radical redistribution of wealth after 400 years of colonial and white power that basically extracted wealth. In South Africa today, like, whites are still generally very wealthy, and that's not, unless you sort of create policies to redistribute, like, wealth doesn't magically transfer from X to Y, right? But that's more radical even than sort of, we accept now multiracial democracy. we don't yet accept the sort of more extreme even measures. And South Africa was a poor country. It's if it does this in 95, well, does the entire world, including the United States and Europe, sort of basically shut down and just refuse to sort of play with South Africa? That was the fear, right? Mm-hmm. And so Nelson Mandela sort of basically and the entire political class went along with not redistributing wealth, which had been part of their plan going back to what was called the Freedom Charter of 1955, where they said they were basically going to nationalize resources, for instance, gold, diamonds, and platinum.
In our remaining minutes, and I just found this study, it's 44% of U.S. workers are employed in low-wage jobs that pay median annual wages of $18,000 a year. Mm. Just quickly, my dad was a union sheet metal worker. He's retired now. And in the late 70s, they went on strike for 3 months. Okay, this was the late 70s. Mm-hmm. They got a $12.50 raise an hour. So they went from $12.50 an hour to $25 an hour.
Wow.
This was in the late 70s, and here we are fighting for 15.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I hear you.
It's
crazy. I would just say that, like, the interesting thing is that the fight for 15 is an important movement. It's been bankrolled by unions, even though most – it won't be union members who benefit, right? Because if you raise the wages from 8 or 10 bucks an hour to 15, well, that actually benefits tens of millions of Americans, but it won't necessarily benefit union workers. But, you know, if you're an island, eventually that island's going to get swamped, and so it's only wise for union workers to help non-union workers. But the fight for 15 is a good example.
And are you hopeful, just thinking about the teachers strikes, all of the people taking to the streets over these issues?
Well, the Chicago Teacher Union strike of this fall is an incredible example, right, where they struck not just for significant wage increases, but also actually for nurses and social workers in schools, what they called bargaining for the common good, right? And so that their strike was a victory for them, but also actually for all students and parents in the Chicago public school system, mm-hmm. right? That's similar to the LA teacher strike, right, of last year. And so I am hopeful. The alternative is slitting my wrist.
Well, we don't want you to do that. Thank you so much for your work, Peter, and thank you for coming in. Peter Cole is professor of history at Western Illinois University and the author of the new book, Dock Worker Power, Race and Activism in Durban and the San Francisco Bay Area. And Peter will be speaking tonight at the California Historical Society if you're in the Bay Area. That starts at 6 o'clock, and it is in San Francisco. You could find information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And coming up tomorrow, actually, it's kind of related to today's show. We're going to mark the 50th anniversary of the police murder of Fred Hampton, a top leader of the Illinois Black Panther Party who really fought for a multiracial group of people to engage in class struggle. This is Your Call. Thank you for joining us.